welcome to the European Journal of Plastic Surgery Journal Club. Together with Plaster and Icoplast, we bring you the latest open access articles with unique insights from the authors and discussion with plastic surgery experts around the world. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy this month's episode. Hello everyone, and thank you for joining us for this month's episode of the European Journal of Plastic Surgery Journal Club. I'm your host, Demetrios Rhesus, and I'm a plastic surgery registrar in London, UK, and I'm president of our trainees association called Plaster. Today we'll be discussing and appraising a new open access article recently published in EJPS. It is entitled, One Stage Treatment of Chronic Osteomyelitis with an Antibiotic Loaded Biocomposite and a Local or Free Flap. It is written by a group of eminent authors from Denmark, and we're honored to be joined by them all today. Firstly, Dr. Anne Lortensen is the first author of the paper. She is a resident in plastic and reconstructive surgery at Copenhagen University Hostel. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Lortensen.
Hi.
And secondly, Dr. Lillian Engel is a senior consultant in plastic surgery at Herlev University Hospital in Denmark with a specialist interest in microsurgery. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Engel.
Thank you for inviting us. We are very excited to have this meeting with the other part of the world tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And Dr. Hans Gottlieb is the head of the section of infection surgery at Herlev University Hospital. He leads a multidisciplinary team who undertake approximately 130 osteomyelitis procedures every year. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Gottlieb.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And the senior author of the paper is Dr. Magnus Obinar. He's a consultant plastic surgeon at Herlev University Hospital, and he leads the Technical Simulation Center at Copenhagen Academy for Medical Education and Simulation. He also created and currently manages the hospital database for osteomyelitis cases. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Obinar.
Hello, Demetrios. Thank you for having us tonight.
And as our independent expert today, we're honored to be joined by Dr. Oscar Manrique. He is a board-certified plastic surgeon and fellow of the American College of Surgeons working at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He has a specialist interest and expertise in the full range of microsurgical practice, including breast reconstruction, oncologic and trauma reconstruction, lymphedema surgery, gender-affirming surgery, vascular composite allotransplantation, and minimally invasive surgery. We very much look forward to hearing his thoughts on the article today, and thank you for joining us, Dr. Manrique.
Thank you so much, guys, and also happy to meet the other side of the world today.
And from EJPS, as always, we're honored to be joined by the editor-in-chief, Dr. Horatio Meyer. He is the deputy head of the plastic surgery service at the University Hospital Italiano de Buenos Aires in Argentina. He is also the chairman of the education committee of Icoplast, and he is a driving force that brought us all together for this journal club. So thank you very much for joining us again, Horatio.
Thank you, Dimi.
And last but not least, we're joined by Dr. Luis de Cordova. He is a plastic surgery resident in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and he's going to summarize and appraise the article for us. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Luis to begin his presentation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the invitation. Hello to the other parts of the world, and let's get started with this article that I really enjoyed. The article title is One Stage Treatment of Chronic Osteomyelitis with an Antibiotic Loaded Biocomposite and a Local or Free Flap. The authors declare no conflict of interest. Being a retrospective study, there is no need for ethical approval. And all patients sign informed consent and a consent regarding publishing photographs. No funding was received whatsoever. The article starts by defining osteomyelitis as a prolonged microbial infection leading to tissue necrosis, sequestrum formation, and bone destruction. They describe the standard treatment protocols, usually characterized by multiple surgical interventions, debridement of the infected bone, and overlying soft tissue management of the dead space with administration and removal of local antibiotic loaded substrates, soft tissue closure, and long periods of systemic antibiotic therapy. They refer to the first study describing such a protocol, as the title says, that is one-stage protocol originating from the Oxford Bone Unit Infection Unit, that they describe the treatment and follow-up for 100 patients over a year, and the introduction or advent of Serum G, that is the antibiotic-loaded composite that they use, comprised of calcium sulfate and hydroxyapatite, an injectable, biodegradable, and loaded with gentamicin, and working as an osteoinductive bone void filler. The materials and methods they use as an inclusion criteria. All patients treated with one-stage protocol for chronic osteomyelitis between February 2017 and September 2019 with a one-year follow-up. The exclusion criteria included patients with tissue closure performed by direct closure or negative one therapy. The diagnostic criteria, they used clinically criteria, which were fistulating infection between skin, bone, joint, and or osteosynthesis material or abscess formation in relation to bone, and osteosynthesis with material in combination with infectious biochemistry and radiological verification of bone edema, destruction, or sequester. The data collection was made retrospectively and from electronic patient records, including age, sex, BMI, smoking, alcohol, and drug abuse, and some clinical data, comorbidities, diagnosis, localization of osteomyelitis, etiology, type of clot, and soft tissue closure used during treatment. As the title says, the surgical management is a one-stage surgical intervention by a multidisciplinary team composed by orthopedic and plastic surgeons with a CT angiogram in all patients who needed a free flap and a local flap with possible vascular compromise. The surgical protocol, it included extensive debridement and excision of affected soft tissue and bone till paprika sign was encountered. They were taking 5 deep tissue samples as minimum with different instruments and irrigation with a physiologic solution. Serum NG injected for dead space, local bacterial and infection treatment, and then the local or free flap was raised and used a split skin graft when needed. Regarding to outcomes, the antibiotic treatment was stopped minimum 2 weeks preoperatively, and postoperatively they continued for 2 weeks empirically, and with culture results they would adjust for a orally or 4 weeks minimum additionally. The outcomes, they were primary flap survival, complete survival of the flap with no necrosis and no revision surgery required, and secondary amputation, death, and recurrence of osteomyelitis. In total, there were 11 patients included, 8 males and 3 females with no comorbidities, 2 current smokers and 2 previous smokers, 10 with osteomyelitis after surgical trauma, and one of them had osteomyelitis after soft tissue infection. In regards to soft tissue coverage, local flap was made in 6 patients, 1 reversal lateral arm flap, 1 soleus flap, 2 gastrocnemius flaps, 1 latissimus dorsi flap, and 1 fascia plantaris flap. 5 free flaps were raised in it, and 3 gracilis muscle flaps, and 2 anterolateral thigh flaps. The outcomes overall was a follow-up of 28 months, with 9 patients presented on eventful healing, and 2 patients experienced major complications, no amputations nor mortalities. For those cases that they are summarized in Table 1, the case one is a 50-year-old female with a Vitamax index of 39, diabetic with hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, and a smoker. She presented fibular osteomyelitis, and a free microvascular gracilis muscle flap was recent for her, which presented a flap venous thrombosis, and revision surgery was needed for the next day for venous anastomosis. On the 13th day, revision surgery was made again due to the venous vitality, superficial debridement, and negative pressure wound therapy plus a skin graft 3 weeks after the first surgery. 6 months, she presented a recurrence of osteomyelitis and a 4th surgery was needed. The case 9, which was the other case which presented the adverse events, it was a 79-year-old female with body mass index of 29. She was hospitalized for meningitis, a past smoker, and due to severe sepsis, she developed disseminated intravascular coagulation and left calcaneus osteomyelitis. A local fascia plantaris flap was recent with MRI angiogram control. 2 weeks, she needed a flap removal, and 2 days later, for those 2 weeks from the first surgery, revision of calcaneus and conservative wound treatment was performed. 10 months, she had a second one-stage operation with a local propeller flap and revision in the 5th and 14th day after the second stage operation. So, for the outcomes, 2 of the 11 included patients experienced partial or complete flap necrosis. Both recovered following revision surgery and avoided amputation in all of them. Significant comorbidities were that one was an active smoker and the other one a past smoker. Flap survival, as we know, relies on the recipient site vascularization, and smoking is a known risk factor. So the flap will facilitate this, as we will see in the conclusions. For soft tissue closure defects, size and localization of the defect availability and vascularization of tissues surrounding the defect, the choice of the closure depends on the health status of the patient, including diabetes, vascular diseases, obesity, and smoke, as we saw in the patients which were obese or fat and smokers or had a past smoking status. They performed CT angiography in both donor and recipient sites. The authors also made an important statement appraising the importance of a multidisciplinary team and a highly specialized center for creating a one-stage protocol for the treatment of chronic osteomyelitis, involving plastic surgeons at an early stage in planning the surgical management, and as well as orthopedic surgeons. As we can see, this study proves that one-stage treatment of osteomyelitis is using anti-myeloid-loaded BR composite lead to several amputations in a highly comorbid population. The limitations that it presents is that they're a small sample, short follow-up, since it was 28 maximum follow-up, and the heterogeneous patient material that is presented.
Thank you very much, Luis. That was a great summary of the paper. Really well presented as well. Thank you very much. I'll just ask you a few questions just with regards to a focused critical appraisal. You touched on some of the points already, so we'll just ask a few of these. But firstly, and importantly, do you feel that this paper addresses a clearly focused issue and important issue?
Yeah, it addresses a sharp focus on osteomyelitis one-stage treatment. That's it.
Perfect. I completely agree. And have the authors taken into account all the confounding factors that are important for this study?
I would say they did, but I would have liked to have some maybe bone biopsy prior stage and the pre-op stage patients. I guess that would be it, but I guess they address all the confounding factors. As they're not addressing a cause-effect relationship, I guess they're just proving that once the treatment is available, possible, and reproducible.
And you touched on it at the end, but just lastly, I'd like to ask you, did you feel the follow-up was enough for the conclusions that they've reached?
Osteomyelitis complications can present way further at the end of life of the patient. So I guess that maybe further studies with a longer follow-up would be necessary, but 28 months for the viability of the flap, I guess it was good. For recurrences of osteomyelitis or complications secondary to osteomyelitis, I guess we would need a little more time.
Lovely, thank you. And just the last question now, and the fundamental question, do you believe the results of this study?
I do believe it. And when I read that question in the cast, I think that it's not a faith dogma or something that needs to be believed on or not. It's clearly done, reproducible, and that would be it. That would do it. Numbers, results, and that's it.
Lovely. I like it. Thank you very much, Luis. That was a great summary, and thank you for your appraisal as well. And now I'd like to hand over to Horatio to ask a few questions of our authors and Dr. Manrique as well.
Thank you, Dimi. First, I would like to congratulate Luis for his very good presentation. And of course, the authors for the very interesting study and for choosing the European Journal as the outlet for their work. I have some questions for the authors. First, at the end of the paper, they do acknowledge that the economic point of view is out beyond the scope of the study in terms that they know they don't enter in terms of cost of the antibiotic composite. But I think that it will be good to know how much does it cost in average. I mean, is this product too expensive? Is it possible to, after analyzing the saving that you actually are having by applying this treatment and in terms of reduction in length of stay of patient, reduction in the number of four surgical procedures. I mean, it is possible to have a rough idea of the cost?
Hi, my name is Hans Gottlieb. I think I can help you with some answers according to the price of the product. There has been some papers lately coming out of Oxford where they evaluate the price of osteomyelitis surgery. And they see that specialized centers with multidisciplinary teams is much affordable and it's a good way to spend your money. And the worst way to spend your money, according to this way of surgery, is badly administered surgery with new methods, no antibiotic regimes, new products for every type of surgery. So the key thing here is to use the same regime. According to concerning the price of the product, we have some surrogate measurements in the paper where we say how many times have these patients had surgery before this one-stage surgery, and how many times do they have surgery after this one-stage surgery. And due to the decline in numbers of surgery after the one-stage surgery and the price of just one surgery, this product is very good value for money. In Denmark, we've been looking a bit about the cost of one night in a bed in a hospital. And if you can save just two nights per patient, then this product is almost free. So it's better for the patients. We sent them home earlier, and it's also a good value for money surgery because we see them fewer times in our outpatient clinic. We have them fewer nights in our beds, and we do surgery less times with this one-stage regime.
Yes, we are talking about hundreds of euros or thousands of euros.
So the health economic aspect is something we are looking into overall. To just drive right into the price, I think we're paying around 1,200 euro for about 10 milliliters of this product. And on average, we're using, I think, a little between 15 and 20 milliliters per patient. Some patients just use a half of a vial of 10 milliliters. Some patients require multiple doses to fill up the bone void that's left behind after doing the debridement, the bone debridement. And as Hans mentioned, the comparison we're doing here is prior hospital admissions, prior antibiotic days, outpatient visits, visits to wound clinics, and the accumulated costs of all this by our current estimates are much, much greater than the price of the product, even when you're using multiple vials at one time. So you're correct that this is an expensive product, but we are hoping to show, and this is coming out later, that there is a saving, even though the product itself costs more here and now.
Thank you. Another important thing that we need to bear in mind is that by applying locally a product that is able to release antibiotic and in that way reaching a minimal inhibitory concentration in a much more effective way, if we are providing perhaps the same antibiotic but through the IV, for instance, like other more toxic antibiotics like the vancomycin, that the large treatment through the IV could be a real problem. So everything must be considered. A few years ago, there is a surgeon from the Netherlands, Oren Lapid, from the University of Amsterdam Medical Center, who reported the use of the gentamicin collagen sponges for the salvage of breast implants. So my question is there any other field, any other area, or any other region where this plastic surgeon or the orthopedic surgeon works, where this kind of products, where gentamicin collagen sponges or the antibiotic loaded biocomposite can be useful? Do you have experience in any other field or any other anatomic region?
Thank you for a very good question. This product, I think, is relevant in every part where you have bone defects which cause removal of bone, dead tissue and infected bone which are badly perfused. And it has to go to handle the infection. And it is close to prosthesis. If you under the prosthesis have some bone defects and some bone deterioration and a gap you have to fill, then this product can be used, and also in every other part of the bone, both cancellous bone and Portugal bone. In most of our patients, we don't use external fixation or internal fixation because the way that osteomyelitis infects the bone is preferably in the cancellous bone. So the weight-bearing part of the bone is often enough for us to avoid any external or internal fixation. So we revise the bone, take out all the badly perfused infected bone, fill this bone blood filler in. And there has been a new paper published from Oxford where they look at kidney problems after this product, and they haven't seen a rise in kidney problems, and we haven't either. We haven't seen any rise in ATINs or whatever in our patients with this product. And also from blood analysis, it stays very much in the bone where we put it in. With this product, we can get to 1,000 MICs, and when we use the IV drugs, we get 2 to 4 MICs. And let me just finish by saying there's just recently been analysis with microdialysis with focus on the amount of antibiotics coming into the actual bone and to the different parts of bone, and it's very, very low. So a very, very small part of the drugs from systemic antibiotics get into the relevant part of the bone. So we think the combination of removing the infected and badly perfused dead bone and injecting locally very high concentration of this antibiotic carrying bone void filler is a very good idea.
Thank you very much. Very, very, very interesting field of research. Well, those are my questions. I think that we can continue with Oscar.
First of all, thank you, Dr. Meyer, for the opportunity to be here with you guys today, and Dr. Fernandez for his great presentation for the authors, as I think it's a great paper and brings innovation and trying to think outside of the box. So congratulations. I just have a couple of questions. The first one, it seems the title of the paper is a one-stage surgery, but on the outcomes, you guys talk about flap survival. So just to kind of clarify it a little bit, was the goal to decrease the amount of surgeries or to improve the flap survival for people who have chronic osteomyelitis of the limbs?
Thank you for a good question. So the idea is to try to optimize the treatment for osteomyelitis patients, because the standard treatment involves multiple surgeries. So we focused on a subset of patients that needed a substantial amount of tissue debridement. That means also big soft tissue defects. So they needed plastic surgery assistance to close the defects. So the one stage is more minded on the osteomyelitis treatment, in that they were only treated with one surgery with a multidisciplinary team, where they had the closure of the soft tissue defect at the same time as they had the controlling of the localized bone infection.
Okay, good. So what do you think about the complication rate that you guys reported on the flaps of 18.2%?
Well, I mean, it's a very, very small sample size. We only have 11 patients. Two of the patients experienced some major complications with the flap necrosis and needed multiple surgeries afterwards. So, I mean, it is quite a substantial amount of complications, but it is also a patient group that has very, very large amount of comorbidities. Both patients, one was an active smoker with a lot of comorbidities. The other one was a past smoker, but had a preceding very serious infection with meningitis, sepsis, and disseminated intravascular coagulation. So it is a patient group which is very difficult to treat. So it is relatively high complication rate, but also very complicated patient group to treat.
Okay, I see. I guess my other question is, as an example of the two cases that you guys presented that require multiple trips to the OR, and I think Dr. Gottlieb brought it up of trying to minimize costs, when does this one stage start? Because it seems that several of the patients prior to that one stage required debridement and washouts. So when would you consider this a one stage surgery?
Yeah, thank you. I'll try to answer that. We started with this one-stage regime, which we copied as hard as we could from the bone infection unit in Oxford. We had our first patient February 2016. This one-stage regime is the sampling, which I guess also answered a bit to Louise, that we can't get bone samples prior to the surgery because it's a part of the surgery. So this is included in the one-stage regime, that we take deep tissue samples, we revise the bone, we flush out the bone, we put in the gentamicin containing bone dot filler, and we close it in one surgery. The idea, operation, as I said, came from Oxford. And that is sadly because in Denmark, before this regime, we didn't have any firm, strict regimes. Surgeons could do whatever they liked. As you can see at the numbers, some of these patients had surgery many times before the so-called one-stage regime. And actually, it should not only cover the one-stage regime, but it's actually more referral to the center where we work, where we provide the one-stage regime. So some of these patients were treated at other hospitals, local hospitals, and then referred to our center when complications rose and the local hospitals couldn't handle the surgery.
I just might add, the primary purpose is when you define the one stage is that you are able to provide a closure, because if we do a surgery when we already know that we have to operate the patient again for a secondary closure, that wouldn't follow this regime. So that's why we're dependent when we do these operations on plastic surgery to provide the primary closure of the defect. Because if you do a debridement of the bone, you install the bone void filler and you don't close this, you'll have a lot of leakage. The product itself might actually just leak out of the bone. This is a known issue with the bone void filler using, it has wide leakage. But if you don't close the area, then you introduce the risk of secondary infection. So the whole idea is to plan a surgery that complete the treatment in one stage. Of course, some patients, you don't have a 100% success rate. This is evident by our data so far. But that is the idea, to not have planned further surgeries and try to minimize the risk of complication for the patient in the future.
Got it. Now, I see that you guys also give, for some patients, oral, IV, and the biocomposite. Do you think that probably had a little bit of difference in the outcomes, or how do you guys would explain that, those treatment protocols that you had?
Yeah, maybe it's not clearly described in the paper, but we have some very strict regimes according to our empiric antibiotics. When we did the paper, all of these patients got 2 weeks of IV antibiotics, which after fourth or fifth days, where we got our answers from the microbiologist, were focused on the actual bacteria. And after the 2 weeks of IV, we gave them 4 weeks of tablets. Now there's a big publication called the Oviva trial. It's concerning oral versus intravenous antibiotics. And after that publication, January 2019, we have changed our regime to 1 week of IV before we changed to 5 weeks of tablets. So we use this 6 weeks systemic antibiotics because it's still a part of the regime coming out of Oxford. And as we speak, there is a study going on in several infection units in Europe. It's called the Solario, where they try to randomize between 7 to 10 days of systemic antibiotics and 6 weeks of antibiotics to have the right length of the systemic antibiotics after the surgery. So the first Oviva trial was concerning the IV or oral antibiotic administration. And now this second study, which is still going on in Europe, is concerning the length of the systemic antibiotics. But it's true that we combine the systemic antibiotics with local antibiotics.
Now, do you think that the etiology and the size of the wound would also change some of the outcomes, or what do you think?
I think one of the most important factors that we've seen is the immune status of the patients and comorbidities. As Anna said, a lot of our patients, not only the one that we did together with our plastic surgeons, but patients with osteomyelitis, they have a higher rate of psychiatric diagnosis, diabetes, smokers, than the average population. So this is a late stage or end stage problem in these patients with high amount of comorbidities. And yes, I think that the origin of the reason for the osteomyelitis and the scarring of the soft tissue on top of the bone also has something to do, of course, with the results. But as we've seen from other patients with osteomyelitis, their comorbidities, their self-preservation, their cognitive function, and immune status, as I said, is very imperative for success in these patients.
If I just might add, these are the patients that we operated with plastic surgeons. We also have actually quite a lot of patients that we operate and able to close directly. And in those, we do see worse outcomes with patients that where the osteomyelitis originates from a soft tissue infection. If you look at the data, most of these patients are diabetics that have chronic ulcers that have then transferred to the bone. And obviously with that comes worse blood perfusion and other comorbidities. So the patient group in itself has a worse outcome. And you can debate whether it's the end stage of the osteomyelitis that defines the outcome or if it's the patient itself. And I, as Hans described, I think it's the patient itself. The original problem is there and not in the bone infection we're looking at. That's just the end product of the long progression of disease.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Manrique. I've just got a question for Dr. Engel as well. I can see in your department, you work very closely between the plastic surgeons and orthopedic surgeons, and you talk in the article about the importance of a multidisciplinary team. Can you just elaborate a little bit for us what the setup is for your multidisciplinary team and how you approach these patients as a team?
Thank you for a very good question. When we just started this up, we didn't really have a setup, and it is very important to have very strictly rules about how these patients are treated through the system. And the way we see them is on the first visit, we see them together, a plastic surgeon and an orthopedic surgeon, so we can define how much debridement do we need to make, how big will the soft tissue defect be, what kind of flap can we use to finish up and close the defect. And then we find out if we need any other examinations, scans, angiograms. And then we plan the surgery together, the free flaps we do in the plastic department and the local flaps we do in the orthopedic operation ward. And also after the surgery, it's very important that the patients are very closely monitored, and the orthopedics actually have an internal medicine doctor working for them to be sure that they are treated not only the osteomyelitis, but the the whole patient needs to be treated. And we experience that it has a very important factor that the patients are taken care of all the way around, and in a, that is not only the orthopedic surgeon or only the plastic surgeon, because it's equally important to have the orthopedic, the plastic surgeon, and the internal medicine, so the whole patient is treated.
Lovely, thank you very much. And with regards to your selection between local and free flaps, you've discussed it a little bit in the article, but did you find any preference in your own practice, perhaps, for free flaps in certain circumstances?
I think I can answer that question. We always try to use the flap which is least important for the patient. So if we can use, for example, an ALT flap where we only take skin and subcutaneous tissue, and the patient will not experience any muscle loss, then we prefer to do that. And we know that when we do local flaps, success rate is higher than when we do free flaps. So each individual patient, we put them into categories and find out how can we treat them and do it so they will have as little damage as possible afterwards. And of course, being sure that we have enough soft tissue to cover the defect.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's a really interesting technique. And I just wondered if I could ask perhaps Horatio and Oscar Manrique as well. If you are faced with these cases, do you tend to use a similar technique? Have you got any experience with these antibiotic-loaded biocomposites? Or do you have other techniques for these cases? Perhaps to Dr. Manrique first.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So I cannot agree more with the authors, Dr. Engel and the group. I mean, I think that for any type of these injuries or trauma, I think the etiology is important because, of course, as you guys mentioned, the higher the comorbidities, age, diabetes, smoker, of course, I mean, that brings a whole gamma of complications, not only from the reconstructive cells, but the medical treatment. So I think that at least in our hands, what we try to do is something very similar of a multidisciplinary approach. We're not too aggressive with the debridement at the beginning. We're not going to have soft tissue to cover it. It doesn't make sense to clean someone's wound, do it aggressive debridement, and we don't have a free flap or a local flap to do it. So we try to do those in potentially one stage if possible. We don't have too much experience with these composite antibiotics, but I know that in some other occasions, especially for prosthesis, when they have to be removed or anything like that, we can use other type of seed, antibiotic seeds that we leave them. We do the debridement, we do the soft tissue coverage with a local pedicle or free flap, and then come back at a second stage and potentially put the prosthesis. But it can vary also from hospital to hospital. But I agree with you guys of the multidisciplinary approach and a clean wound before you try to do any type of final coverage.
Thank you very much. And Horatio, have you had any experience or your thoughts on this technique?
Yes, unfortunately, at my hospital, these kind of cases are managed by the orthopedic surgeons. They work alone. So I'm really envious, Leland, about you recruiting the orthopedic surgeon to work together as a team. I totally agree. I mean, one of the main problems, I mean, in this part of the world and many other Latin American countries is that many of these products are not available in our markets. And if available, they are almost prohibitive. I mean, we can't afford that. The health system can't afford the cost of these products. So this is the main problem. I would like to come back to the question of Oscar regarding this patient receiving additional antibiotic treatment per mouth and through IV. I think that the best way to confirm, you know, that, of course, as mentioned by the author, there is a previous clinical experience with a very important number of patients of the Oxford unit with experience in among with these products. But I think that by adding a control group without this composite, I know that is a very heterogeneous group of patients. They could do a retrospective study of a similar cohort of patients and then compare results. And they also can use the number of amputation, the number of flap losses and the number of bone complications. In that way, they can gain more evidence, I mean, in terms of that, just by adding a control group. And so they can compare the original group where antibiotic-loaded composite was associated to the antibiotic administered by the IV per mouth. And then a previous historic group where this composite was not used. And then by comparing the two groups, they can have a level three study in evidence-based medicine. And in that way, we can answer Dr. Manrique's question that how we do know that actually this composite works. We all know that it works because there are previous works, I mean, in the literature, there were that as a proof that this actually works. But I think that by adding a control group, this question can be answered.
Thank you, Horatio. I can see a lot of nodding from Magnus and Hans and Anna there, so I'll just bring them in to say about their plans for perhaps that or any further work that you're doing.
Just a couple of follow-up comments on that, because this is really important. First of all, regarding what you said, in countries that can't afford this product, what is the solution? I think one of the things this regime has brought is it allows the orthopedic surgeon to do the debridement that is necessary to clean out the disease. Because as Oscar mentioned, if you end up with a defect that's too large, the only other option is amputation. So I think you'll see historically that our patients before we call it the salami method, we refer to it, they have multiple small amputations. You keep debriding the same wound and cutting off. And the fear is that you don't act aggressively enough, and because you can't clear out a complete tibia and just leave a hole there. So I think that if you have plastic surgery available, another way to introduce biological material to do the dead space management basically would be to do, for example, a free muscle flap and put that in the defect, and at the same time provide enough support for the bone to provide stabilization, because the cerumen does not become rock hard over a week. It doesn't give you the tensile strength immediately. It takes over a year before it transforms into bone material. So that would be my choice if I was in a country where I had no other option, was to try to fill the dead space with some other option, biological live material, like a free muscle flap or something. And in regard to the study suggestion, you're absolutely right. We introduced this product in 2016 and went from 0 to 100 within a day, because all of a sudden we were using this. It had excellent evidence from studies abroad. And then at some point it becomes too late. When can you stop use? Can you, from today, just select half of our patients to not receive what we think is the current best standard treatment?
Yeah, let me just comment on that, because it's completely true, Horatio, that regimes prior to this product has also been described. There's a paper from a US surgeon from 1937 where they had no antibiotics, where they still could clear out an amount of, I think it's about 75% of the osteomyelitis they could treat with repetitive surgery, and they didn't have any antibiotics. So I think it's more realistic to describe the regime that you're standing across than to, for example, go back to 1937 saying, okay, now we just do surgery 8 times on these patients and see how we can clear the infections compared to the regime we have today. And the last thing is that when we introduced this regime, we had no data. I mean, we are the only center, the only MDT center in Denmark collecting data. So my predecessor, he was very esteemed, and everybody said, oh, he's a great surgeon, and he can do everything and things like that. And we just, for example, compared the number of larger amputations, and we had dropped the number from around 100 to 65, 62 a year. And we didn't even know that, because they didn't have any data before 2015. So this is just a way to measure again the effect of this regime.
But you are right. To raise the evidence level, you need to compare this to something. Yeah. And our current best option is to look at previous studies. To look in our past, we don't have any registry of operations previously performed where we have osteomyelitis and you need plastic surgeons to cover the defect. We don't have this data. So it becomes really hard for us to do a comparison. And that is a weakness. So looking in the future, we need comparison studies.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Of course.
Randomized control studies, ideally. So.
So just last comment, we've done a bit of surgery on some pigs with osteomyelitis to seeing the effect of this product. It's also, again, of course, a surrogate measurement, but to see and to confirm actually that it's the surgical debridement that is the key factor here. And if you don't debride these pigs, then you can fill in whatever you want. This magic paste will not work if you don't debride sufficiently.
Yes, yeah, I totally understand. Just a suggestion, in these cases, you can, if there is any academic or clinical center in Denmark treating the same kind of patients, you can, in your own city or in another city, you can invite your colleague to compare their experience with your experience. So you can choose a group and you can match a control group. Even though it's, of course, there is another surgical team, but I think that by comparing those groups of patients, you're going to have further evidence. So in that way, my friend Oscar cannot ask that.
Thank you, Horatio. It's been a great discussion and really, really interesting concept. There's a couple of questions just from the audience that I'll pose to the authors, if that's okay, quickly. We've touched on the cost element, and I guess we talked about a few of the other techniques that can be used, and we just mentioned those, but are there any other alternative products similar to this, other than the CERAMENT, that could be used?
We've actually only been using CERAMENT because when we took in this product, we did that based on a publication that Magnus mentioned before, going out from Bone Infection Unit in Oxford from 2016. It's also referred to in the paper, this incredible cure rate. And the problem, as Magnus also mentioned, is it's very hard to go back when you have very good data on a product. It's very hard to say, well, if you don't have any indications that the other products are better, then it's very hard to go back. They have done it a bit in Oxford where they have compared this current bone void filler, the CERAMENT, with the former two or three bone void fillers. And they have seen that they have fewer complications and fewer failures with CERAMENT than with the predecessors. But I think there are about 112 bone void fillers at the market, so you can pick whatever you like. I know there are groups in Europe that are using some other bone void fillers. Pivotal thing here is to use a strict regime. And as Dr. Engel said, be very true to this regime. And that's why, of course, you have to be open for other possibilities. But if you don't have any data giving thoughts to better ways, then it's very hard to argue that you want to change bone void filler.
Nice, thank you. It seems that's definitely the first choice product at the moment. And just before we finish the discussion, one more question from the audience, perhaps for Hans as well. It says, do you have any experience in treating prosthetic associated infections with this product?
Not personally, no. The way we treat at our facility prosthetic joint infections is that they have surgery at another hospital and they're referred to our ward for the following antibiotic treatment. The prosthetic joint infection surgeons don't use this product. And it's, again, maybe an answer to Horatio and Oscar, according to the problem about getting data on your regimes. Because Horatio is completely right when he said, what about comparing your regime to another hospital? But the fact, as I said earlier, in Denmark is that we are the only hospitals with data on what we do. And there has been a cultural thing in Denmark where surgeons would like to say, but every patient is different. I do surgery different time on every patient and I do it the best of my abilities and the best that I can offer this patient. But data has shown that it's just not true. You have to have regimes, you have to do surgery and antibiotic regimes and do it in the same way every time. And then of course do it together with some very good colleagues that you know and work with in the OR and the operating theater and the outpatient clinic.
Thank you very much. Dr. Manrique.
Yeah, just one suggestion. I think since you guys have strong data, probably for the follow-up, I'm just guessing with a higher number of patients, probably look into a multivariate analysis so you can take out of the equation all these other things that we're talking about, like size of the wound, location of the wound, how many times they went back to the operating room, because I would say that or the type of flap that you use for reconstruction. Because for example, for me, I would guess it is not the same as having a wound this big that has one this big, or someone who already went to the operating room like 10 times and now comes to use this regime versus those one that just went in one straight shot. So that your data is even more significant. That's what I would probably suggest.
Thank you for the suggestion. The cooperation with the plastic surgeon, as you can see, is over, even though over a 2-year period, it doesn't provide very large numbers, but we do have, I think, approximately 360 patients with osteomyelitis that we've operated with this regime since 2016. And the rate has been rising every year as Herlev Hospital, our institution, has basically become a bone infection unit for the region. And so we're getting more and more referrals over time. So we have over 550 operations total. These are just the ones we've entered and checked in the database. We estimate, approximately 550 operations to date. So multivariate analysis is definitely something we will be doing, taking into consideration some of these factors that you mentioned, because it will help surgeons in the future decide what is the most correct regime or treatment option in this case.
Thank you very much. They're really interesting comments and questions, so thank you very much for those. And with that, I think we'll end the discussion of the article. It's been a really, really interesting paper and really interesting points coming out for hopefully all of the plastic surgeons listening and the trainees listening as well to start to incorporate into our practice in whichever country we are. So thank you very much for that. Just before we end the journal club, I'd like, if we can, to ask both Dr. Obina and Dr. Manrique just for some advice and tips for the trainees listening in particular. Perhaps Dr. Obinar first, what advice would you give trainee plastic surgeons and orthopedic surgeons even who want to combine research and collecting data and improving practice alongside their clinical practice?
Well, I think my immediate advice would be to identify key people in your department or in your hospital that are doing research, because I know that at our institution, we have a lot of researchers. So typically younger physicians interested in doing research, they will approach one of the senior consultants in their department that are actively doing research and ask if there are any projects they can be associated with. The way we typically do it in our department is that we have a professor who manages all our research projects, not directly being involved necessarily, but being the person chiefly responsible for what is going on in the department. So any young researcher would approach that person in our department and ask, what research projects are going on? Is there anything where I might contribute? And that person will then typically identify someone else in the department who is performing relevant research and will know that this person might be interested in a helping hand. And often the first task is performing data analysis, doing maybe a little bit of background research. And once you show a little bit of potential and interest, then it can quickly develop into an independent article over a very short period. We are very happy to accept new researchers in our department, and we always welcome anyone knocking on our door asking if we have anything. We call it desk projects, like some idea we had at some point but haven't gotten around to initiating yet. We have quite a lot of those. So yes, identify key researchers in your area, especially if there's someone doing something that you might be particularly interested in, and simply knock on their door, bring a cup of coffee and have a chat about what they're doing and where you might become involved.
Thank you. That's great advice. Yeah, just taking the risk and asking the questions and visiting the right people is the key first step to success. So thank you so much for that. And Dr. Manrique, I'd like to ask you as well, what advice would you give to the trainees and the residents who want to get involved in particular in microsurgery as part of their training and for future career?
Well, I think that I cannot agree more with Dr. Obina that you need to be exothermic. So basically very enthusiastic in terms of getting something out. I learned from prior mentors, there's no secret juice. You just have to go for it and have a specific question and a hypothesis and be very critical with what you do, because there's no other way to improve or innovate. And I think based on this article, which I think is fascinating, is thinking outside of the box and trying to think about other options for treatment of the patients that we see. And in terms of microsurgery, I think that it's a tool that we can use as plastic surgeons that would give us the ability to do other things. But I think, again, people have to be just enthusiastic about it and go for it and try to learn from your attendings or consultants what they do, what they see, and then apply that for the near future.
Amazing. Thank you very much. That's great advice there to everyone really working in medicine. Magnus, did you want to
Yes, I just wanted to add what he said. He actually touched upon something that is very interesting, thinking outside the box. Just a recommendation to my young colleagues out there. If you see something that seems kind of odd, don't be afraid to ask the question, because sometimes the answer is just that we haven't really thought about it. And often that can initiate a fantastic journey into research and discovery. So don't be afraid to ask questions if something doesn't make sense. And if you have an idea, even if it comes completely from a different field, different specialty, or complete not outside the medical field, don't be afraid to bring it to the table. It might be the next big thing.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Very inspiring advice there. Thank you very much, both Dr. Manrique and Dr. Albanov, for that. That was amazing. And with that, we'll end the Journal Club. It's been a fascinating discussion about a really, really interesting paper that's going to change practice going forwards. A really interesting discussion about the principles behind it as well. So thank you, everyone, for your contributions. I'd like to thank the whole panel, really, starting firstly with Oliver Jones, who's here as well, who's been live tweeting the key points and taking questions. And we'll also be editing the recording for the podcast to be available on demand as well. So thank you, Ollie.
Thanks, Jimmy. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you, especially to Luis for his great presentation and summary of the article and his appraisal as well. Thank you very much for taking the time to read and prepare that, Luis. And thank you, as always, to Horatio for bringing us all together every other month and picking a great article every time as well, and especially with this article today, and for your great questions as well. Thank you, Horatio.
Thank you, Dimi. And also, I would like to express my gratitude to my friend, Perikos Foroglou from Greece, and from the ICOPLAS board. He is always there when we organize a journal club. So I would like to say thank you, Perikos. And we hope to see you, all of you, again in 2 months, perhaps in September.
Absolutely. Thank you, Horatio. And thank you especially today to Dr. Oscar Manrique for being our independent expert today, for asking such great questions, and especially for your thoughts at the end there and inspiration for the trainees. Thank you very much.
No, thank you once again to the authors, phenomenal paper, to Dr. Meyer for the opportunity to be here, and for you guys for the invitation today. Thank you.
Thank you especially to our authors. We're lucky to have all four of them today. So thank you firstly to Dr. Anne Lorenzen.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
And thank you as well to Dr. Lila Nengel.
It was a pleasure, and I hope we continue sharing our opinions across the world.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thank you as well, Dr. Hans Gottlieb.
Thank you for inviting us. As the other authors think, it was a pleasure for letting us discuss our regime and our setup and our MDT collaboration between plastic surgeons and orthopedic surgeons.
Yes, it's a beautiful thing to see. Thank you so much. And last but not least, thank you to Dr. Magnus Obinar for bringing everyone together for the article and for your comments today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's been really inspiring talking to you all, and the questions, it shows insight into the field that I think is very valuable to share, especially with our younger participants. And it's also been very inspiring to hear from members across the world about what situations you might be just thinking about the price of the product in a different context than we do here in Denmark. It really makes you think and tells us to keep working to see how we can to figure out solutions that work for all of us across the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I couldn't agree more. And thank you again for a great discussion, everyone. Have a great rest of the day, whichever country you're in. Thank you for listening to this month's European Journal of Plastic Surgery Journal Club. Please send us your thoughts about the article on social media using the hashtag EJPS Journal Club. Thank you again, and see you in 2 months for our next episode.